For the week of October 5th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 252, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at a local diner in Twin Peaks, Washington, enjoying a, excuse my language, damn fine cup of joe, I'm Michael Giltz.
Okay, so I knew you were going to start the show by saying that you were somewhere near Twin Peaks, Washington, or the like.
They're reviving Twin Peaks.
Well,
wait.
If you're going to get into that story right away, then hold on a second. Give me just 1 second. Okay, now go. I thought maybe you could use a little musical accompaniment. No,
I appreciate that. So the last time I interviewed David Lynch about Twin Peaks, I gave my pro forma. Hey, you know, obviously people always ask you, and I go, but you wouldn't, you know, is it like just out of the question or any? And he paused a long time and said, "Well, you know, if I got an idea, you know, why not? You know, I would. I'm not refusing to do it. It's just I haven't had the right idea. If I do have the right idea." And we feel excited by it creatively? Sure, why not? And by God, I guess they did, because they're reviving Twin Peaks. It's coming to Showtime. They're going to do 9 new episodes. They'll air in 2016. He and the co-creator, Frost, are working on the scripts right now. It's going to be set in the present day. It's not a remake or a reboot. And it's going to follow right along from where they were. But with time having passed, you know, it's 20 years later or 25 years later, whatever that is. And that's what they're going to do. So I assume Kyle MacLachlan will be available, though they haven't discussed casting yet. But I think it's very exciting.
I remember when this show first aired on ABC and everybody thought, oh, it's not doing well. It's going to get canceled. It's a little awkward.
It was
a huge hit.
It debuted as a massive hit. It fell down afterwards. But it debuted right as hot as any show ever. You know, it was opposite Cheers on Thursday night, a terrible time slot, and it did tremendously well. It was the highest rated TV movie of the year, that initial 2-hour pilot. And it did great for the first few weeks, really through the end of the first season. It was only in the second season when they solved the murder and things got weirder and weirder that it took a tailspin. But, you know, they moved it around a lot and all that. But no, it began very strongly, got great reviews and had huge ratings right from the get-go. It just fell off a cliff. Yeah, so that's exciting. I'm excited by that. I'm already at Twin Peaks hoping to be cast in the background, maybe holding a log.
Watch the show, which is, I think, 18 years old at this point. So you'd actually have to go back in time to get the DVDs and watch it. A lot of the people who are excited about this weren't even born when the initial series ran.
Well, it just came out on in a new Blu-ray box set. Okay. And it finally has the actual pilot, because the previous box set did not have the first 2 hours of the series. For various ridiculous, insane rights reasons, they would have a complete box set of the show without the initial pilot. I mean, it was crazy. So now, finally, everything is on there. The pilot, every episode, the feature film, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, lots of extras. That just came out like a few weeks ago. So it's literally available for the first time in pristine form. So anybody who wants to catch the show has the way to do it. But if they're catching our show, what are they going to hear about?
Well, I know at the end of the show, we're going to be telling them that they can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or they can call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. So if you hear anything on the show or you want to give us feedback, please feel free to write or call, or of course, follow us on Twitter or Facebook or the like. But on today's show, we're going to be joined by Brooks Barnes, one of my favorite entertainment business journalists who is part of the all-star team over at the New York Times. Brooks will be stopping by to tell us why director Christopher Nolan's next movie, Interstellar, is being released on analog film. You know, that stuff with sprockets, the little holes.
Celluloid.
He'll also help us dissect the deal that had all of Hollywood's tongues flapping last week. This is the agreement, which will see Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, the sequel to that film, distributed simultaneously in IMAX and on Netflix. Actually, you know, Netflix was a big newsmaker last week. They also announced a deal with comedian Adam Sandler to make 4 different movies. We'll explain what the ramifications, if any, are for the film industry and with that little bombshell. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Of course, we're talking about box office around the world, not just North America. We get our info from RentTrack. We have a link in the show notes. We also pull information from Variety and The Hollywood Reporter and The LA Times and anyone else who happens to cover worldwide box office. But we do it better than anyone, by God. And the number one movie around the world, just like in North America, is the new David Fincher film, Gone Girl.
But wait, I thought it wasn't. I thought it was the Chinese film. Did the Chinese film? What is the breaking?
No, no. This
breakup
is the
buddies?
Number one. This is the number one movie around the world.
Oh,
you're talking
okay.
Overseas. The highest grossing film was Breakup Buddies.
Breakup
but we're
buddies,
looking at worldwide right. box office. We're not looking at just the U.S. or just China. In China, they'd say the number one film is Breakup Buddies. In the U.S., they'd say the number one film is Gone Girl. In some other country, they'd say the number one film is The Equalizer or The Maze Runner. It just depends where you are in the world. But we're looking at worldwide box office, the total box office from everywhere in the world, not just overseas, not just North America. We add it all together.
Well, this
is what
happens when the
number one movie around the world is Gone Girl, which grossed $62 million over the weekend.
This is what happens when you actually just read headlines and you read a headline that says...
Well, it's an international box office.
Yeah, China and India rule international box office.
Well, they did. Big movies in China and India were huge hits. They opened up very strongly. But if you add up the whole worldwide box office, that's not the number one film. Anyway, why are you confusing people? We've been doing this for years.
I'm sorry.
You glanced at a headline in Variety and thought you knew the results. You should have looked at Rent Track. You should have looked at the show notes. The number one movie around the world is Gone Girl. It grossed $38 million in North America and another $24.6 million overseas. Other movies grossed more money overseas, but when you add it all up together, number one, Gone Girl, David Fincher film. It debuted at the New York Film Festival. I couldn't get to see it, so I haven't seen it yet. I was too busy, though I'm seeing other films at the festival. It's at $62 million. That's basically the budget of the film. So that's a very good opening weekend for them. And number two, around the world, still not China, still not India, it's Annabelle, a horror film. That was looking neck and neck with Gone Girl, but the adults came out for that movie, which is based, of course, on the best-selling book by Gillian Flynn. So Annabelle was, you know, breathing down its neck, but Gone Girl, the quality release, held it off. Annabelle is this cheapo horror flick spun off from the Conjuring series. It grossed $60 million worldwide, $37 million in North America, another $23 million overseas. I don't even know what the budget for this film was, but it wasn't a lot.
You know, when I saw the trailer for this film and I saw the commercials, there's this doll featured in the film.
That's Annabelle. Got to watch out for her.
I mean, you look at the doll and you immediately think, oh, my God, this must be a horror film. Look at that doll. Who would keep that doll around? You just know it's going to, as soon as you fall asleep, it's going to come to life and stab you. I mean, I don't know why. It's one of those, like, implausible films, because you just know that doll is not just a doll.
I think Variety and Forbes said the budget is about $6.5 million, so that's 10% of what Gone Girl cost, and it's grossed 10 times its budget on opening weekend.
Yes.
And number three around the world is a Chinese comedy. It's Breakup Buddies. It grossed $38 million worldwide. That brings its total to $93 million. It's already been opened in some territories. Breakup Buddies is the Chinese comedy. It's about a washed-up singer who hits the road and the bars after a big, messy divorce, and he brings his best pal in tow. The two guys who star in it also starred in Lost in Thailand, which was a massive smash hit in China and in other countries. And Bo Huang, if I'm saying his name right, he played the Monkey King in Journey to the West, one of the more recent versions of that classic tale. That was a smash, huge hit in China. The Wall Street Journal reports that Breakup Buddies is sort of an envelope-pushing film. I mean, these guys are obviously huge stars, and they have a lot of clout. But China, just like India, sort of is a very conservative box office territory. You know, people don't kiss in Bollywood films. In China, a lot of topics are off limits. But this film mentions homosexuality. It mentions infidelity, which apparently is a no-no, but it's there and it's in the movie and it's playing on screens and it's a big, big hit. At number four around the world is the Denzel Washington film, The Equalizer. That grossed $32 million. It was a really good weekend at the box office. A lot of strong performing movies. It just passed the $100 million mark worldwide. And number five is The Maze Runner, which I like to call Boys in a Box. Another $28 million, and that's about to pass $200 million worldwide. And then at number six is that India film. That film from India, it's called Bang Bang. It's a remake of the Tom Cruise, Cameron Diaz film Night and Day, which is sort of an action comedy flick. This is the same thing. It's a remake, but because it's Bollywood, it's 44 minutes longer than the Tom Cruise film. It's 153 minutes rather than 109 minutes. I don't know whether they worked in some musical numbers, but it grossed $25 million worldwide.
Even including, by the way, $1.2 million in the United States.
That's right. It opened up here on, you know, there's a circuit now. There are big theater chains like AMC 25 and others in Manhattan, and smaller specialized chains that specialize in films from India or Asian territories that regularly show Bollywood flicks. You can catch them opening weekend a lot of times here in New York City, at least, and I'm sure perhaps in LA and some other big cities.
And
so
in
that's
Canada.
Kinda cool.
Yeah, and in Canada as well.
And in Canada, well, wherever there's an Indian population, I guess, this or fans of good movies that are really long. they come out. So bang, bang, $25 million. Dracula Untold is at number 7. This is the sort of origin stories for Dracula. It's a big spectacle. It's not getting good reviews, but it started its run overseas in about 25 territories. I think it opens up here this weekend. It made $21 million wherever it opened. And number 8 is The Box Trolls. That made another $18 million. Also not well reviewed, but it's making some money. It's at $60 million worldwide. And number 9, this movie took me a little while to track down, even though it's like the second in a series. It's Black and White,
Black and White. The Dawn of Justice.
The Dawn of Justice. This is a Taiwanese film. It's the second one spun off from a TV series. It's sort of a Die Hard type thing. And it's about a cop who, in this case, partners with a gangster to save the day. And it stars Mark Chow, who also starred in Young Detective D, another very successful film that we talked a lot about. But it was a TV show. It's a movie. Now this is the second film. They're pulling in the bucks with Black and White. And at number 10, unfortunately, a really big bomb from your former boss, Left Behind, starring Nicolas Cage. $6.8 million in North America.
Yeah, you know, I heard this movie being reviewed on the radio and on television, and I just thought, oh my gosh. Like, when you hear the audio from it or you see clips, you just think, wait, you can't even, are we supposed to be hate watching this movie? Because it looks so bad.
Well, the original version of this, it's based on, of course, the best-selling novel, a series about the Rapture.
Right. And I think the original film, because this is a remake of a 2000 film starring Kirk Cameron.
Well, I don't know why you make a face about that. He was a big TV star at the time, merging into movies, and is a strong conservative figure, if that's the right word, you know, very, very conservative figure in his politics and his religion. And so he embraced the movie and has made lots more films like it. But yeah, that was, I think, practically, it wasn't straight to DVD. It had pretty good job at the box office, didn't it?
I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I think Left Behind, the movie, that actually grossed it only made $4 million at the box office, but I think it was a big success on DVD. You know, maybe I'm making that up, but they made multiple sequels to it. So obviously they felt there was some audience. This movie, I have no idea what the budget was, but it's a Nicolas Cage film. You know, he's had lots of hit films. He's had ups and downs like anybody else. This was not a big budget movie. It cost $16 million to make. So far at the box office, it's doing pretty modestly with vicious reviews and $6.8 million in the till.
Well, you know, speaking of an actor that has had ups and downs, there is somebody who's had probably more ups than downs. Adam Sandler was in the news this past week.
That's right. I mean, Netflix made a lot of noise. We're going to talk about Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon when we get to Inside Baseball. But we're going to start by talking about their deal with Adam Sandler, which followed up one day later. They said, hey, we're in the Adam Sandler business. He's hugely popular for our audiences all over the world because Netflix is now in 50 countries and counting. And they see that all these demographics, all these people, all these countries, people like to stream and watch Adam Sandler movies. So they said, hey, Adam, you're on the outs with Sony. You used to have a big deal there. And now your production deal with them is over with and you're looking around. Why don't you make some movies with us?
Yeah. And I mean, certainly, you know, a couple years ago, Adam Sandler had a deal with, well, for 15 out of 18 films he made with Sony Pictures at one point. Grown-ups.
They've been his home.
Yes, and that's where his Happy Madison Productions was based out of. And I guess, you know, Sony said, hey, we're going to be making fewer films and they're going to cost less money. And of course, everybody went, oh my goodness, Sony must be out of money. And so he took Blended over to Warner Brothers, which of course wound up not doing very well this past, I guess it was spring.
It almost tripled its budget, the stated budget of $45 million. So it certainly made money for them, but it was not a big success. It grossed $125 million worldwide.
But, you know, Adam Sandler he's had more hits than misses. But he's had some misses, and, you know, Sony's making fewer films. Heck, Hollywood is making fewer films, and they're mostly making films that have a high budget, that have a franchise potential, and those are not the types of movies Adam Sandler generally makes.
Right, he makes mid-range comedies.
Right.
You know, they're in that sweet zone of like $60 to $80 million, which studios hate.
Right.
And their comedies, which don't always play well overseas, which studios also hate. Though Adam Sandler does have a strong worldwide following. You know, his last few movies, he's been on an upswing, actually. Blended got very bad reviews. That's his reuniting with Drew Barrymore. But it did almost triple its budget. Grown Ups 2 was a sequel. That did great. That made $250 million worldwide. And Hotel Transylvania, his animated film, that did really well. That grossed $360 million worldwide. Then you've got some flops, but then you've got more hits again. So he's been a dependable guy. Netflix looked at their stuff and looked at all their data and said, you know what? People like to watch Adam Sandler films. So what is this? Is this Netflix moving into movies? Is this Netflix disrupting the industry? What's happening here?
I don't think it's Netflix disrupting the industry. I think Netflix is a distribution channel. In this case, it's a direct subscription video on demand. It's like HBO in a way. You pay for content. You pay $9 a month, you get content. Netflix goes
out. And everybody wants original content.
Right. Netflix, up until now, well, I should say initially, was licensing content from the studios and production companies and television networks. And now they're saying, hey, you know how we could make even more money? If we could pay less money for content. And one way to do that is to have content that we produce ourselves that nobody else has.
That's right. They, of course, want a big library because they want you to come to Netflix and find a lot of stuff for you to watch. So last year, or this year, I think they're spending $3.4 billion on all the TV shows and movies that are available on Netflix. Only about 10% of that is for original programming like Orange is the New Black and House of Cards. And then coming up next year, the Adam Sandler films, you know, moving down the road. But you know, they still are spending $3 billion on licensing content. So they're always going to want as deep a library as they can because that makes it a more valuable experience for people who come to Netflix. But, you know, original content gets you attention, gets you noise, gets people to say, yeah, you know, maybe Third Rock from the Sun isn't available right now. And that annoys me because I just expect everything to be on Netflix. But you know what? I really like Orange and New Age Black. I really like Adam Sandler. It's worth my $8 a month. The same way you do it on HBO. You don't watch everything on HBO, but you say, I really want to see Game of Thrones.
Yeah, you know, I remember a couple years ago when Netflix first started getting into original content. Mm-hmm. I think I was at Show East, or I was at some convention where one of the acquisitions executives from Starz and another from HBO were saying, is Netflix a competitor? They were asking kind of rhetorically. Let me tell you, when I have to compete against you to get content, then yes, you are a competitor. When you're buying the material that I would have licensed, you are a competitor.
So I think we would agree that Netflix isn't disrupting or changing the movie business so much as joining the movie business and joining the TV business. But I'll tell you what is a little different here. HBO, when they get someone like Tom Hanks or, you know, Michael Douglas and Matt Damon to come to HBO and make a movie, it's because it feels like a movie that won't work as well in a movie theater. It's a project that feels made for TV, not in the sense of smallness, but in the type of story it is, the type of film it is, or you're doing a miniseries like From the Earth to the Moon or Band of Brothers. It's a project that doesn't really make sense for theatrical. In fact, Spielberg almost took Lincoln to HBO because he couldn't get a studio to make it for the longest time. What's different about Adam Sandler, unlike the TV shows that Netflix is making, unlike the movies and miniseries that HBO makes, is that Adam Sandler comedies feel like a theatrical thing. They're movies.
Yeah, but they also are, you know, it's fine if you watch an Adam Sandler comedy on video.
Exactly.
So it's not like you're missing something on the big screen.
That's right. You can crop it, frankly. You know, all we want to see is Adam Sandler. Your Grown Ups 2 does not suffer from being watched on your tablet.
I would agree with that.
Right. And so they're not mostly the type of movies that need to be seen on a big screen, unlike Crouching Tiger, but which we'll get to down the road. So yeah, his films are costing a lot. And Netflix says we're going to make Adam Sandler comedies. These aren't weird, quirky, offbeat things that no one else will make. They want to make broad mainstream comedies. They say they're going to spend the money that Adam Sandler is used to spending. That means $60 to $80 million. I don't know how his deal will work since there's no gross or other things to be involved in here. Will they sell it in countries where they don't have Netflix? I would assume so. Why not? Will they put it out on DVD eventually? I would assume so. Why not?
Well, look, but they put Orange is the New Black out on DVD. They put House of Cards out on DVD and Blu-ray. So yes, they will. And yes, they will distribute these movies theatrically in countries where they do not have deals. If it's not Netflix that's distributing it, they will sell the rights in those countries.
More to the point, they'll sell the rights. They're not going to become a distributor suddenly.
Right.
They're not going to set up a system for that. So it is disruptive. It's exciting. It's a new buyer, so talent likes it. But it's no different than AMC launching a TV series or HBO making a movie. It's just another outlet where you can shop your project.
Well,
so,
and if you're Adam Sandler and you're looking at all of these studios saying, Adam, we know you've been making about $15 million per film, plus possibly even $5 million as a producer, but here's the deal.
How about $8
million? Yeah. We're going to be making fewer of those movies first. So, you know, instead of you making two movies a year, why don't we make one movie every 2 years? And, you know, the budgets of those movies are going to have to come down. Well, first of all, he now takes Happy Madison on the road to Netflix, where he kind of doesn't have to worry about, you know, raising money for each new film. And he maintains his salary level and his quote. And at the same time,
I don't know if he maintained his salary level.
Well, that's true. But at the same time, you know, Netflix viewership, they don't really state what the viewership for any particular piece of content is. So if something isn't successful, then you never know it.
Yes, that's right. If you make That's My Girl or whatever, what was that called? That's My Girl? Yeah, That's My Boy or Jack and Jill, and they don't exactly set the world on fire, or Zookeeper. So what?
Yeah. Well, and I guess really
there's a little less pressure.
And I guess really the only way you know whether something is successful or not successful on Netflix
they do more of them.
Well, they do more of them, and it becomes a part of the cultural conversation. If you're not becoming a part of that conversation, then, well, maybe your content isn't being watched.
Well, but it's not like Mad Men, where, you know, you're going to become a, you know, you're not suddenly going to start talking about Grown Ups 2 as part of the cultural conversation. It's just a movie people watch and enjoy.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing that's interesting here is that HBO and Netflix, with the movies and the miniseries, are filling a void that Hollywood has abandoned. Like you say, these are genres that Hollywood is walking away from. They're wary of making adult films. They're wary of making films for adults. They're wary of making mid-range movies. They're wary of sort of comedies because they don't travel well overseas. They're wary of making, you know, westerns and film noirs and musicals. Maybe these outlets will step up for all these other genres. You know, like if Woody Allen was around today, the way he was in the early 80s, where he would sort of had a dry spot, you know, after he'd had a lot of hits, he had a dry period. But he was always sort of making movie year after year after year. If Netflix had gone to Woody Allen and said, hey, you can make your next four films for us, we'll budget that, you know, we'll give you $30 million for each film, he'd say, sure, why not? You know, he gets to make his movie a year, it gets out, people see it or they don't, there's no pressure, you know, what's not to like?
I don't know. I you know, maybe, I don't know. Do people watch the Netflix? I don't know.
And is there, and there's the loss, there's the cutting in expenses of marketing the movie, right? I mean, I'm sure they'll have TV ads and print ads touting when the first Adam Sandler film comes up. They had a big campaign for House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, but it's not on the same level as a movie,
no,
as a feature film.
No, not nearly as much. And plus,
House of Cards, I don't know, but really it's not.
Right, and the only reason they're doing that is to get new subscribers. They're not doing that to get people who already subscribe to watch the thing, although I guess in a way they are, but those subscribers, when they log into Netflix, they see whatever Netflix wants them to see, and in this case, it'll probably be the Adam Sandler movie.
Exactly. They probably do it a little bit geared to who you are, but for their big projects, they're always going to have them right on the front page. So when you log into Netflix for like 3 months after it's available, there's Adam Sandler. So there's no marketing needing to be done. It's like you go log on to Netflix, there's the movie.
Well, I wouldn't say no marketing, but certainly minimal.
Right. Relatively speaking. So that's a big savings in money too.
Yes. Well, speaking of saving money, or at least spending money, SoftBank, we talked about them last week as the venture firm that was going to invest a whole lot of money in DreamWorks Animation.
You insisted it would happen.
Did I insist that would happen?
I thought you did.
No, I was saying that I could understand why they... Well, yes, maybe I didn't. I'd have to go back. It was last week. You expect me to remember anything I said last week? In any case, they didn't invest any money into DreamWorks Animation. That deal seems to have fallen apart, but at the same time, I guess negotiations were going on with Legendary, which is the production company and financier, film financier that invested in, they had a deal with Warner Brothers, invested money into the Batman franchise.
And Godzilla and stuff like that, yeah.
Right, and they then took that deal, they went over to Universal Pictures last year, And so they have a new deal with Universal. And along comes SoftBank and says, hey, here's $250 million. Don't spend it all on one movie.
That's what it costs to make one movie like Godzilla or The Dark Knight. But yes, so they've invested in Legendary. They've got two more payments scheduled of $375 million if they choose in the next few years. And they have first right of refusal to buy Legendary outright if and when Thomas Tull, who's the head of that company, decides to sell. So what are they doing? They're just creating content, right? They want to get content for some reason for their mobile devices around the world.
And they own a lot of internet distribution, basically internet providers. So yes, they're basically saying, we have a distribution channel, distribution technology. We'd like to own what's being pushed down those pipes.
So Legendary, of course, has been investing in making movies. They're moving heavily into television. They got a shout out for Chris Hardwick.
I was really surprised about that, actually.
Yeah, they mentioned that as one of the examples of how they're moving hard into TV. Chris Hardwick's Nerdist brand. Well, good for him. He's a player now. And I guess they want to turn them into sort of a DreamWorks.
Yes.
They're like not a major studio as such, but they're starting to churn out more and more product of their own, 6 or 8 or 10 films. I don't know what their goal is, but they're trying to ramp up Legendary to make more original product, I guess, because it doesn't work if you're just partnered with another studio, does it? It's not about investing in other films. It's about creating your own properties, right?
Yes. They're not doing this saying, hey, here's $250 million. We'd like to invest in your business. No, we're investing in your business so that you go out and make content that is yours that you can then bring back to us that we can then show.
So we're always happy to see new people with money, deep pockets. They loved it when the Arabs came in the 70s and the 80s. They love it when anybody has a lot of money and comes to Hollywood and says, hey, where can I make? I want to make movies.
Yeah,
and Hollywood says, step on in.
Right.
Come on.
For a while, it was like the German lottery funds, and then it was hedge funds, I guess, in the 2000s. There's always somebody showing up with money.
God bless them. I wish they'd show up in money here. So do we care? Is it just another example of a foreign company with deep pockets playing the game of Hollywood?
Well, I think we care because SoftBank has been trying to get into the entertainment business in one form or another for a couple of years now. They made a bid for Universal Music Group, as we mentioned last week. This is one of their forays into entertainment that's been successful, and they're looking to continue and increase their activity in that area. So it will be very interesting to watch where they wind up and how they fare in what is a very volatile and, as you know, risky business.
That's Masayoshi Son is the head of SoftBank. And I would just say, Masa, I hear there's a podcast in play.
Ooh, which one?
But following up on another story we did, we talked about Tom York, the lead singer from Radiohead. He had his album appear out of nowhere on BitTorrent. It was a bold use of BitTorrent where you could pay for your music. What about that?
Well, it's funny. I think albums appearing out of nowhere is the new black. Because,
oh, absolutely.
Because, Beyoncé did it. I think Taylor Swift is doing it. And
no, she's not doing it. We know it's coming.
We know it's coming. That's true.
It's been on the cover of Rolling Stone, for God's sake.
Yeah, okay. I thought that
album came out. People like to make a surprise.
U2. U2 did it.
That was a surprise. Absolutely. That's a good choice. So Tom York, we got some figures from opening weekend. The album was downloaded 400,000 times in the first 3 days of its availability. That's on the BitTorrent network. So that's, that's a great start. 400,000 copies. That would certainly make you the number one album in the country. But Billboard isn't going to count those sales, I don't think.
Why not? It's $6. I thought they counted everything over $3, and this is $6 per album. And, $6 feels about right to pay for a digital download that is...
Ouch. Well, the number one album on the charts this week is Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga with Cheek to Cheek. And Tony Bennett became like the oldest person in history to have a number one album.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
I don't think he's not the oldest person to have the longest span between number one albums, because he didn't have a number one album until his like duets album a few years ago. So it was a long time before he had a number one album. And this is another number one hit. And there you go. So great for Tony Bennett. Right below him is Kenny Chesney. And then Barbara Streisand is down a couple notches, and Alt-J. And at number five is Pentatonix with an EP. That's all the rage now, because the EPs chart on the charts just as well. So as of this week's chart, those Tom York sales were not counted. I don't know why or how. They may not be official reporters to Billboard. They've never done it before. So they may just not have had the system set up. If they had been, it would have been number one. In my mind, that's a big deal.
Oh, I know those magic words. If you're saying that that's a big deal, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story? What's the most watched TV channel in prime time on all of cable? For the first time since 2003, it's Fox News Channel. Thanks, racial unrest, terrorist groups, and famous celebrities dying too young. Based on ratings from 8 to 11 p.m. Mondays through Fridays in the third quarter of 2014, Fox News Channel averaged 1.79 million viewers, more than the other news channels and more than even stalwarts like ESPN and USA. If you expand the hours, you know, if you add an extra hour from, like, I guess what, 7 to 11 p.m., then Fox was number one for the first time ever. Bill O'Reilly is still number one, with Megyn Kelly growing strongly. The highest rated show on CNN? What do you think it is? The miniseries The 60s, which ranked higher than Anderson Cooper. It improved overall, and in the key demo, edged past MSNBC for second place in the news channel race. And why bother with news at all? On CNBC, reruns of ABC's business competition show, Shark Tank, remain a big hit, outscoring every single show on MSNBC. Is all this a big deal or a big whoop?
It is big news. I'll tell you what interested me most about this. One is CNN. I mean, I've seen my brother, whenever I go to my brother's, they're watching some episode of the 60s. You know, it's always being aired and re-aired. It's on all the time, or they're just calling it up on demand. You know, they're watching that miniseries. So that's one. And Anthony Bourdain, which I wonder how well he's doing for CNN. He's,
you know, I saw that he had this show on CNN, and it's fascinating. And I thought, why is Anthony Bourdain on CNN? I don't know, but that show is really good.
It's a pretty good show. It's interesting. It's a cooking travel show where he goes into the culture and the area and stuff as much as the food. But it's an odd duck. And you think this is the future for CNN. You want to have branded shows. You want to have events and documentaries and miniseries and things that make sense for your channel, but which can bring people in on a regular basis other than just talking heads doing the same thing everyone else is doing, or, you know, waiting for breaking news.
Well, Jeff Zucker was interviewed, I want to say, in the New York Times and one other place, maybe New York Magazine. I don't know. He was interviewed over the weekend. Those stories broke, and he's now the head of CNN. And those are the first big interviews he's given since taking over as the head of CNN.
Mm-hmm. Well, one other thing. This is basic cable we're talking about, not pay cable like HBO and Showtime. But I'll tell you what really intrigued me, though. The averaging in prime time, 1.79 million viewers. That makes you number one.
Yeah, you know,
I put that into context. Major networks like, yeah, come on. If we had 1.79 million viewers, we'd be canceled unless you're on the CW.
Right. And I know television producers who produce reality shows or shows for cable networks who are like, oh my gosh, my show got 500,000 viewers this past, you know, week of 500,000. I'm like, okay, that's what they're ecstatic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's a huge hit.
Absolutely. So that just, and you know, they do have big shows on cable that reach a lot of people, 6, 8, 10, 12, 18 million people. But there's also a lot of other shows that don't. So it's when you got hundreds of channels and thousands of shows, it's hard to reach a big audience.
Print is still king when it comes to book formats. A new survey by Nielsen says that the most popular format for books is paperback, which accounts for 42% of unit sales. And note, that's unit sales, not dollar grosses. The second most popular format? Hardcover, which accounts for 25% of unit sales. Third is ebooks, which account for 23% of unit sales. That leaves 10% for, I don't know, I guess audio CDs, digital downloads, and I don't know, maybe board books like those children's books. I don't know. Since ebooks are often cheaper, that would imply their percentage of sales in terms of dollars would be even lower. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, I think, because you're getting such a small snapshot of what's actually going on. This doesn't include Amazon. Doesn't include Kindle, doesn't include all those indie authors. It doesn't include a lot of stuff. It doesn't include used. So it's a really distorted image of what's going on in books. I don't buy that ebooks are 23% of unit sales. I think they're a lot higher than that. Maybe they're including textbooks or something. I saw another one that said ebooks were like 50% of all gross dollar amounts for the publishing industry when you include Amazon. I'm like, well, what is it? Are they 25% of unit sales and thus probably only 20 or 15% in dollar amount? Because ebooks are usually cheaper, or are they actually half of all business? So I don't think this is a very good indication of what's going on, and you know it's not when information from Amazon is a black hole.
Disney is coming to the rescue of one of its theme parks. Disneyland Paris has never been a smashing success. But now, but now the parent company, which owns 40% of the park, is propping it up with $1.25 billion in funds. They're giving it a $500 million cash infusion and turning $725 million of debt into equity. It's a big test for Tom Staggs, the head of Disney Parks. He's been listed as a front runner to replace Disney chairman Bob Iger, the heir to be, Bob Iger's been there for 10 years now and just got a contract extension. But launching Disney's parks in Shanghai and turning Disneyland Paris around are two key challenges Staggs must face in order to keep momentum in his favor. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. They've got to do something to shake it up. It's never quite worked. I've never really understood why Disney didn't own a majority of all their parks overseas or all of them. You know, it's such a good business for them. I don't know why they'd ever want. I guess they have creative control. I mean, they're never going to allow someone else to, decide what happens in a Disney park, right?
Well, there are also political reasons for that and legal reasons for that in foreign territories where you have to kind of give up certain ownership so that you are a quote unquote French company.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Euro Disney is actually its own company.
Ah, I see. Well, that's true. And if you want to get into Shanghai, you're going to have to make a deal with the Chinese.
Right.
You know, they're going to say, yes, you welcome. We'll take your money.
And I mentioned Bob Iger's contract was renewed for an additional or extended for an additional 2 years. So he will be the CEO until June of 2018.
That's right. He's not stepping down anytime soon. A lot of things can change, but Staggs can certainly help his case by making a success of Shanghai and turning around Disneyland Paris. I think they should have more Can-Can.
Oh my gosh. Well, that stunt with U2 and Apple was pretty cool. Apple paid them, the band, maybe some $20 million. And in return, U2 saw its new album placed in the hands of 500 million people around the world. The only catch? The album wouldn't be eligible for the Grammys because no one had actually bought it. The album was coming out commercially, but after the Grammy deadline for the 2015 awards. That means Songs of Innocence, the U2 album, wouldn't be available until the 2016 ceremony, by which time U2 plans to release another album. So their digital stunt needed a savior. And that savior turned out to be vinyl, ironically, an analog format. The band rushed out some LPs so the album could be available for sale before the deadline and thus eligible to win some awards next year. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, of course. It's very funny. But they couldn't put out CDs, I guess, because that would spoil the Amazon fun, right? Because then you could rip your CD and put it on your library. So they made it an LP because it's less copyable, it's less easily or less obviously something that you would rip off and or make available digitally. So it's kind of hilarious. And in another related music news, the Turtles, we talked about them suing Sirius XM. Well, they're not done. Now they're suing Pandora.
Well, and you said that it would ruin Amazon fun. I think you meant iTunes, but yes.
Oh, it would ruin the fun for iTunes. Look at me. I'm getting them all confused.
Yeah, well, welcome to the world of digital distribution.
Maybe we should outsource our hosting.
Well, every website wants original content. That's the takeaway from the announcement that Facebook will be hosting movie shorts which extend the Twilight franchise. A panel led by Stephanie Meyer will select female directors to make shorts, each of which will focus on a different Twilight character. One assumes the original actors won't necessarily be involved, but, on the other hand, Taylor Lautner may not be all that busy, so maybe they will. The shorts will be hosted on Facebook, promoting the site, the franchise, women directors, and a few other things we haven't thought about yet. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop.
Okay.
Well, but seriously, should Facebook be making shorts? Should they be in the business of creating original content like this? I know everybody wants original content, but it doesn't seem to make any sense whatsoever for that website.
Are they actually making it or are they saying?
No, but they're involved. I mean, are they the home hosting place where you want to watch shorts? Come on. That's not your business at all.
Yeah, well, they are a distribution platform and a social...
But they're not. They're a social media gathering place. They're not a distribution platform. They are a place for people to connect to other people socially. They are not a distribution platform.
Well, a lot of people broadcast their content through there. And by content, I mean written content.
Do they?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Well, they have links to where they go, but they don't broadcast it there. People don't go to Facebook to read content as such, do they? They might find info on it and go to another site, don't they?
Well, they also go to Facebook to read
like
content.
Who? Like who hosts on Facebook all their content?
Not all their content, but...
Well, who does that?
Tons of people. I mean,
we don't
have time to get into that now. I mean, this is, I mean,
I'd have to say many and leave it at that.
Yes, exactly. Trust me. Take my word for it. Now, this next story, it's a 40-year-old rule bit the dust as the FCC voted to eliminate the blackout rule for sports. Under that regulation...
For football, right?
Yes.
Isn't it just for football?
I think it's also... But yeah.
Oh, it's all sports, I guess.
Yeah, and it's a football game. American football, I understand. I wonder if there is a European rule or any international rules that kind of mimic this, or maybe we're mimicking them. But it's if a football game did not...
Oh, I'm sorry. It is for all sports, so I apologize. I misunderstood that.
Okay, well...
So any game, like baseball or anything, yeah.
Well, if any game does not sell out, for example, local TV stations are prevented from airing that game.
Or can be prevented.
Right. This also meant cable and satellite companies couldn't show the game in that market either. The NFL vehemently opposed the change, saying this might depress sales or send football onto pay channels rather than over-the-air networks. The FCC said the NFL can do whatever they want and make whatever deals they want, but the FCC shouldn't be involved in protecting a private business, but really focus on public interests. One commissioner said that most fans can't afford to even park near a game, much less buy a ticket to one. An organization of fans urged the NFL to lower prices. Only two games were blacked out last season, two football games. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's an antiquated rule. It was a dumb rule the entire time that they had no business being involved in. Thank God they're done with it. But when you look at the NFL and realize only two games were blacked out among all the teams and all the league and all the country, it really doesn't come into play very much. So who cares?
Exactly. Oh, I love this next story.
Why? I hate this next story.
Why? Because Michael was wrong. Can you say that, Michael? The word wrong. Now, it's wrong with a silent W at the beginning.
I was, that's what
I thought. Yeah.
Can't do it.
To be fair, I agreed with Michael as well. We didn't know what the movie Russia would nominate for the best foreign language Oscar was, but we were pretty sure it wouldn't be Leviathan, a bold, politically risky film that got tons of critical praise at this year's Cannes Film Festival. I really liked it, but it also clearly takes shots at Vladimir Putin's Russia. According to the New York Times, the movie seemed doomed when the Russian culture minister said the film had talent, but he didn't like it. I think his exact words were, "Niet." Clear enough for you? Instead, the directors on the committee that chooses the film that will represent Russia chose Leviathan after all. China made a surprise choice as well, going with the French-Chinese co-production The Nightingale rather than yet another Zhang Yimou film. The Chinese master, and that's Zhang Yimou, has had seven films put up for the Oscar, but never won. I guess the Chinese minister said, you know, seven strikes and you're out. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big deal. I go with the conspiracy theory on Leviathan. I don't think the directors thumb their nose at the Tsar Putin. I think it's the government's plan to win an Oscar. Because now that this movie's nominated, I think it'll make the long list and the short list and become a cause celeb. Everybody say, "Ooh, let's show Putin by giving Russia an Oscar." You know, I think they're going to say it'll become the darling for everybody to want to support this movie. It's a great film, a very good director, a terrific director. It does take on Putin's Russia. It does critique the government. And I think they're going to want to show their support for that politically and recognize a great film. And that could very well help it win the Oscar and let Russia, for the first time, take home a gold statue. And where will it land? Putin's house.
That's right. It'll be on his mantle. And he'll say,
exactly. "Very well done. Give me the Oscar.
I own Crimea and Oscar." How to Get Away with Murder, the new drama on ABC's lineup dubbed Thank God It's Thursday, or just Shondaland for those in the know, set a record in the number of people who watched it on DVR. The Viola Davis mystery / courtroom drama reached 14 million in the overnights. Then it added another 6 million on DVR, bringing its total to an impressive 20 million viewers. Gotham on Fox had a bigger percentage leap, but of course, it had a much smaller audience to begin with. You know, I also noticed that NBC's The Blacklist grew 54% in live +3 ratings among adults 18 to 49. Is all this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It's how we watch TV. It's, you know, this people don't line up to watch it on the night. And I still think it's so confusing that we don't get a list. You know, TV Media Insights did a list of all these shows that grew the most in total viewers on DVR. Live plus three is what they did. But the list was just by number of total viewers added. I wanted to see a list for the entire week of all the shows, starting with the biggest. Like Viola Davis, that show's in the top five now. That's great. And it's cool and it's exciting. It's how we watch TV. The ratings system and how they display the ratings and when they tell us who's achieved what needs to change. Why tell us in the middle of watching television? You know, 4 million people have tuned into Blacklist and we'll wait for the second half hour to give you an update. You know, it's like, wait till it's done. Then tell us the total number. Then we'll know and remember exactly how many people saw each show. To me, it's incredibly confusing.
Is Chief Justice John Roberts of the Supreme Court really a superhero in disguise? Perhaps an alien from another planet? All we know is that the Supreme Court declined to hear a case from the estate of Superman co-creator Joel Schuster. They wanted to reclaim part of their rights to the iconic and highly valuable character, Superman, that is. The problem? When Schuster died in 1992, his sister made a deal with a Warner subsidiary, DC, to pay off his final debts and expenses. They did and even voluntarily increased survivor expenses, but with the caveat that this would preclude them from coming back again and asking for further claims. Now, that seems like a bad idea, even though it was at their request. The Supreme Court declined to hear the case, and Roberts, it was made clear that he did not take part in discussions surrounding the case, though no explanation was given. Obviously, the only reasonable explanation is that he's from another planet, like, I don't know, Krypton, maybe? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It seemed like a weak case to begin with. I think it was probably the right decision not for them to hear it. There was no particular conflict, no big issue at stake. And I think Chief Justice John Roberts wears Superman underwear.
Okay, you heard it here first. A decades-long tradition has ended, not with a bang or a giant anvil falling on a coyote or Fat Albert saying, hey, 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 but with a whimper. Yes, the tradition of Saturday morning cartoons is officially dead. Last weekend, for the first time in at least 50 years, no major network aired cartoons during the iconic time slot when kids would gather around the TV and their parents would fruitlessly urge them to go outside and play. Actually, their parents were fruitlessly telling them to turn it down as they tried to sleep in. But in any case, the CW ended its final show, the quiet finale to a process that began back in 1992 when NBC stopped, followed shortly by CBS. ABC joined in with the anti-cartoon stance in 2004. Fox never played that game, and now the CW has called it quits as well. You can still see some cartoons on PBS, and of course, entire cable channels like Disney and Nickelodeon and the Cartoon Network exist. The very reason the big boys got out of the business in the first place. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I guess it's a big whoop. You know, it's been so long in coming, and it's not like cartoons have disappeared. They're just available 24 hours a day, and adults watch them just as much as kids.
That's true.
But
and you know what?
It's a sad little end, though, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah, it is. And you know what? My kids wouldn't even know that they could go to the television and turn it on and watch cartoons on Saturday morning. Instead, they like try and sneak off with a laptop and they watch, I think it's Wayside School or some cartoon that they like to watch on YouTube. They don't television. No, you got to wait through commercials and you got to find the show in the first place. We just go to YouTube and search for it.
Don't they have commercials on YouTube?
They do, but they're very short, you know, 30 seconds, and then they get to watch 10 minutes of content.
Yeah, aren't most commercials 30 seconds?
Yes, but then there's like 4 or 5 or 6 of them in a row.
Ah, fair enough. All right. Well, I guess that's it for Big Deal, Big Whoop, isn't it?
Yes, Michael, that does move us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Joining us for Inside Baseball this week is Brooks Barnes, who, as I mentioned at the top of the show, is one of my favorite entertainment business journalists. He covers media for the New York Times, which is a beat that includes the movie studios, movie theater chains, and broader Hollywood issues like piracy and financing. We asked Brooke to stop by to talk about two topics this week, and IMAX is actually a part of both stories. The first is the decision to release Christopher Nolan's next film, Interstellar, on analog film. The other is a deal to distribute the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon sequel on Netflix and IMAX. Brooks, thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Hey, sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, of course, the first story is Interstellar, and Christopher Nolan is launching this movie 2 days early on celluloid. It'll be available at 240 theaters in 77 markets, where exhibitors are still equipped to do that on 35 or 70 millimeter. It's going to be at the Cinerama Dome in LA, I think, isn't that right? And there's 41 IMAX branded locations. And some sites are even reinstalling a film projector just so they can show this movie 2 days early before it'll be available anywhere else. Is this a big deal? I feel like Christopher Nolan is fighting the war and he doesn't realize the war has already been lost years ago.
That's a good way to put it, but he's a big enough force that he can kind of do whatever he wants. I mean, part of the thing that's so interesting here in an insidery way is that what he's doing with IMAX is kind of the exact opposite of what IMAX is doing with the other matter. You know, he's kind of pulling back toward, you know, the industry's past with Interstellar. And then on the other hand, IMAX is trying to move forward, lean forward with their Crouching Tiger project.
Well, I guess Variety or The Hollywood Reporter had some quotes from certain chains, theater chains, that were very upset. And these were smaller theater chains like Spotlight Theaters. They were upset that they had just spent all this money converting to digital when the studios had requested that they convert to digital. And what is the first thing that happens as soon as they convert to digital or soon thereafter is that the studios come to them and say, oh, you don't have a film projector? Well, that's too bad, because we're going to be giving a really hotly anticipated movie early to those that are showing it in an analog format.
And one of the things that's so ironic about that, or I don't know if that's the right usage of that, maddening about that for the those theater owners, is that Paramount was one of the most aggressive movie company studios to say, we're no longer making our movies available in, you know, on film. So you've got to install all of this expensive digital equipment. And then now Paramount is distributing Interstellar. So, you know, they left themselves a little loophole in that first announcement when they, you know, like, the vast majority of our films will be distributed on digital. But anyway, that's another wrinkle.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you look at it, Paramount was the first studio to kind of break the seal. No studio wanted to go first. No studio wanted to say, that's it, no more film prints. And Paramount said,
right, they never do.
We have no problem doing that. No more film prints. And yet now they're the ones saying, except for Christopher Nolan.
Well, they weren't in the Christopher Nolan business at the time.
Yeah, that's true.
And of course, Christopher Nolan's always had a good relationship with exhibitors. I mean, he goes to all their meet and greets and all their conventions, and he talks about his films, and he's developed a rapport with them over the years, tried to partner with them and make them his friend and support his movies. And of course, he makes very successful films, so they're happy to do it. And now he's done something that really kind of hurts them a little bit, at least the ones that can't adapt to this and, you know, haul back in a 75 or 35 millimeter projection and reinstall it in their cinema.
Even though they're crumbling, and in some cases they will lose money because they aren't able to show it in that way, they're ultimately willing to do it because of his track record. It's not, and not really just because of the Dark Knight trilogy, but Interstellar was such a huge, unexpected movie, and that is kind of what everyone's hoping the bet is for this one.
You mean Inception?
Inception, yeah. Is the model for Interstellar.
Well, you know, part of the problem here is that many theater chains don't actually have projectionists that know how to use a 35 millimeter or certainly not a 70 millimeter projector. That's going to be a bit of an issue for them. So that should be interesting.
I picture someone, like, you know, off at the retiree breakfast getting a phone call, and we need you back in here, Bob.
Yeah. It's like, there's a great short film, you know, I'm back in the game. And he goes back in, and the geeky kid has to step aside while the crusty old man, you know, starts spooling the celluloid back into the machine. he's really doing this for no one but himself. Fans in general don't care. I mean, I'm a cinema buff. Of course, I'm excited to see it on celluloid. That's sort of neat. But I mean, that's over with. Fans don't really care. Theaters have spent all this money to, you know, convert. So it really, I mean, some people say, hey, is Christopher Nolan saving film? No, he's not. It's already lost.
It depends on your viewpoint, but there's certainly an argument that it's a little precious that train has left the station, as they say.
Well, in another bold move, if you want to call the last one a bold move, the Weinstein Company has made a deal with Netflix on one of the most commercial properties in its library, the Weinstein Library. They're currently filming a sequel to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and they've made a deal that will have it debut on Netflix day and date with its theatrical release on IMAX in North America and other territories. And it isn't really like an indie film or an art house project. It's the sequel to one of their highest grossing foreign language films in history, not only for the Weinsteins, but just in North American history. And it was a decidedly commercial film. Showing it on Netflix means like most theater chains in the U.S. will refuse to show the film. Isn't that right?
Right. I mean, the big three chains, Regal, AMC, and Cinemark, say that they will not. They have a general policy where they, unless their window is protected, and that's like roughly a 3-month exclusive window, they won't show anything. And so this is designed as sort of a workaround by the Weinstein Company with IMAX, which operates theaters in all of those chains can control what goes on its screens.
Well, now that's an issue, right? I mean, with the deals depend on the exhibitor that you're talking about. Very small theater chains may not have had the ability to say, no, we're going to control what's shown there. But their deals with the big chains, I don't know their individual contracts, but they certainly seem to think they have the right to say no. And that's how they spoke. And the IMAX is like, well, we're letting them choose as if they're doing them a favor. But what's the actual deal there? As far as a workaround, it certainly hasn't worked out that way because
right. Well, they thought it was a workaround because that's what they announced. And then a couple of the two big ones said, no, actually, we are not letting this happen. What's happening behind the scenes there is that, according to my reporting, that IMAX does have the right to overrule them and say, no, this is what's going on in our theater. But they're not doing that. So that's very interesting in that they're not, they've picked a fight, but then quickly back down and making the theater chains look like the bad guy, if that makes sense.
So the IMAX has never done this before, obviously. They've never said, we want to show film A, and the theater chain said, no, we don't want that film, and IMAX has insisted. It's never happened when there's been a conflict. Basically, all the movies that they're getting, the theaters want to show, like The Dark Knight or whatever it may be, so there's been no issue before. So there's never been a track record of them forcing the issue and saying, we're going to show this film. Are the Weinsteins disappointed that they didn't, you know, tough it out?
I don't think so, because I think that the Weinsteins, especially if you look at how that company operates sort of historically, has operated historically, they got a huge, big publicity pop for this sequel. And I think that has to be viewed in that context. I mean, yes, it's a sequel to one of the best performing Foreman films ever, you know, if you look closer at that film, there's some questions about it. Ang Lee is not back. If it was that's a huge question mark. You just have to kind of wonder, what kind of sequel is this? Is this a route that gets them a big headline? Whereas it would have normally, how do I put this? It gets them a big headline for something that may ultimately have been a directed home video title all along. Does that make sense?
Well, it does if you thought they were spending $20 million to make a direct-to-home video movie on one of those valuable properties that they ever had. I mean, is there a sense that someone has seen footage and that they think it's not good?
I don't know. I think that there's more there than meets the eye is what I'm trying to say.
I thought the same thing when I heard this news. I thought, well, somebody has seen a first cut or the dailies coming in and said, wow, okay, that didn't turn out the way we wanted. We better figure out a way to recoup our money before it hits theaters.
Well, right. One big obvious thing to look at is that Netflix is not in play in most Asian territories. Netflix is not a factor in China or Japan or South Korea, I believe, or in any other key Asian territories like Indonesia. So those are places where they can play theatrically and it won't be an issue. There's no day and date issue. So while the Chinese company that controls AMC, and that's Wanda, they're standing firm in North America. In China, there's no Netflix, so they're going to be happy to show Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon in their country, and that may be the biggest market of all for the movie right now.
It probably is the biggest market. It has a Chinese director, and IMAX has a very big footprint there, and is one of the more successful Western company exhibitors, for sure.
Well, now, okay, let's talk about that for a second. First, just to finish off the IMAX China of it all, in my opinion, this is being done solely for IMAX in China, because 1% of the screens in China are IMAX screens, yet the IMAX gross is 10% of the country's gross. So that should tell you how important IMAX is in China. But now, you mentioned that IMAX is an exhibitor. It was always our understanding that IMAX itself is more of a technology and more of a, it's less an exhibitor than a service provider, if you will, or a content producer.
More like Dolby or something, yeah.
It depends. It's both. It certainly makes its technology, it sells its technology, so that could, you know, makes it squarely a company in that area. But it's also got this whole arm that they've been focusing on more for the last 5 years or so that is just about picking Hollywood movies, whether it has IMAX technology in there or not.
Well, but then are they actually
more of an exhibitor?
But then, and that you kind of mentioned this in your story, that it IMAX being a theater chain or a theater circuit, are they actually a theater chain or a theater circuit, or are they working with those, with, you know, the AMCs, the Regals, the Cinemarks, the Cineworlds of the industry to build IMAX screens and distribute IMAX movies?
It's in the middle. In some places in the world, they're on their own. Here, they contract with the big chains mostly. I mean, it's the company has evolved, right? They still have all of these standalone theaters at science centers, so it's a mixed bag.
And is that where you think you know, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon 2 will probably play at aquariums and science centers and planetariums?
I do not think that, but it's a kind of a funny scenario to think about, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, actually. Now something else that struck me in your story is that when you were quoting figures, you were quoting adjusted for inflation. So whether it was the budget or the gross, you adjusted it for inflation. Is that something that is new that the New York Times is doing, as opposed to saying the film made hypothetically $100 million, which in modern dollars is X?
Right. No, that's our policy. I've been doing box office, I don't know, for 7 years here now. And so the general rule is that if you're looking at something more than a couple of years old, you need to present it in modern, current dollars.
As the only figure that you use. That seems odd. How did that come about? Because to me, especially when it's only 14 years, it seems a little confusing. You know, to me, a phone call cost a quarter or a nickel. A bottle of Coke in 1960 cost whatever it cost. You don't say it costs 75 cents. You say it cost a nickel. Movie tickets cost whatever they cost in 1939. You know, if you want to provide context or show, you know, to keep in mind people that this was that year, then you can present the adjusted for inflation number. But to me, isn't it just a simple fact that the budget was whatever it was reported to be, in this case, $17 million? I mean, that hasn't changed. It grossed $128 million in North America. That hasn't changed. That's a simple fact. When you keep converting it, to me, I get confused about what we're talking about.
Well, we try not to confuse by saying it's after, we make it very clear that we've done that conversion. But I guess your arguments with the New York Times copy desk, so I'm just, holding the line on the policy.
So now I guess we'll say when you drop a dime on someone, we'll have to say that they dropped 37.2 cents on someone, adjusted for inflation.
There you go.
Well, now everybody is saying that, and by everybody, I mean the Varieties and the USA Todays are all quoting executives or sources that are saying, whether it's this Adam Sandler deal with Netflix or the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon deal with Netflix, that windows are collapsing and it's inevitable that big blockbusters will eventually open day and date on Netflix and or in the home and in theaters. How accurate do you think that is?
I think that it will be like that eventually, but I think that the pushback we're seeing on the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon pushback from those theater chains is indicative of how difficult it is. Netflix can say, they're doing all, can thump their chest and yes, we're doing this, we're breaking down windows. But ultimately, when you look at it, it's more of, little cracks and an erosion rather than a shattering. And the press, me and others, love to, you know, not look at that nuance. But I think in this case, it's a slow march rather than a big one.
So, I mean, is it like a generational or cultural thing where, you know, at some point going to a movie theater won't be something that you kind of reminisce about or that you hold dear because, you know, you spent your life playing video games and watching Netflix. So why bother going to the movie theater? It's not something you ever did in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. They certainly are working, doing everything they can to protect that, the theater companies. And I don't think if you talk to the studios, they would say that they want that you know, in theater experience to go away. At the moment, at least, they make an awful lot of money from that. But it certainly could evolve generationally into something where you have more of an option, right? To either see it on a 3-inch screen or however many feet high screen.
Well, to my point of view, the windows have already collapsed in terms of independent films and documentaries and foreign language films. We see countless examples of movies that are available on video on demand or certain channels even before they hit theaters. And of course, these aren't movies that are going wide and coming out on 4,000 screens, but we see that their availability, because they're only going to play in some big cities or whatever the reason is, that's already happened.
Right.
But for the big Hollywood blockbuster film, I'm not sure what the advantage would be. I guess they look at video games and say, wow, if we made the next Star Wars movie available for like $20, we could make $1 billion in one day. And they probably could if it was worldwide. But do they want to really kill the box office? Do they want to give up the chance to make $500, $700, $800 million there and then come out on DVD and video on demand?
It goes back to what you said at the beginning. No one wants to go first. They've survived an awful long time by protecting their business model. And even though there are arguments to be made on this new way, you know, you can charge a lot more. You could charge maybe even $50 to see it super early. No one is really willing to, on at least a big major worldwide movie, to make that decision.
Well, and do you think that a lot of people have been quoted over the past 7 days as saying this whole Netflix IMAX deal, it's paradigm shifting, especially with the Adam Sandler deal that we spoke about earlier. This is a, you know, changing the paradigm of Hollywood. Do you believe that, and do the people you speak to are they saying that as well?
No, to be honest. I mean, I think that that's an easy leap to make, but there are big asterisks on all of this. Adam Sandler, you know, is a person who's having difficult time getting his movies made for the amount he wants to be paid, given his track record, his recent track record, which is not good. And so all of a sudden, you've got someone, an agent perhaps, or someone in his camp that's very smartly going to Netflix, and it's being framed as a, look at this forward thinking, we're changing the world and the paradigm shifting, blah, blah, blah. But ultimately, you know, like with the Weinsteins and that movie, I think that there's more there than meets the eye.
Well, Brooks Barnes of the New York Times, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us about all of these issues, the Netflix Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon issue, the Adam Sandler Netflix story. We greatly appreciate it. Your work can be found at the New York Times. And if you go to Brooks Barnes' Twitter account, at Brooke Barnes NYT, you'll see that Brooks, he resembles really a Muppet, actually.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.
Well, that was good of him to join us. Yeah, I feel like we said before, that Netflix isn't changing the business. They're just joining the business. You know, they're a new player. You want to make a movie, you want to make content, you can go to ABC and you can go to HBO and you can go to Yahoo and you can go to Netflix. You want to make a movie? Same thing.
Well, and we make content. And sometimes when we make content, people write to us and they give us some feedback. They write to us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's exactly what Ferdinand did. He wrote to us about our discussion about Barco Escape on episode 250.
He says, "Hey guys, I love your podcast. Thank you. I just wanted to get involved in the discussion in episode 250 about 270 degree cinema. That's Barco Escape. I think it's a good idea, says Ferdinand. Not for every cinema in the country, but for some films, sure. Humans have a vision of around 180 degrees, except for the nuns that taught me in grade school. So why should a motion picture not use this fully in order to further immerse the audience in the story? It's the same reason why 16 by 9 replaced 4 by 3, more immersion. Just wanted to throw it out there. I would love to watch a movie this way, but since I live in Austria, this won't get here for at least two centuries. Greetings, Ferdinand.
Well, Ferdinand, thank you for writing. And I don't know. I think maybe it might get there within the next 200 years, mainly because I think cinema is only 100 years old. So if you have cinema right now, then technically I think it'll get there sooner than later.
Well, that's cool. And I think it could be fun for certain projects. I just still go back to the idea that we had 360 degree cinema back in theme parks for, you know, 50 years now or whatever. It's been available. It's been possible. It's nothing new. People have never done it before, so why suddenly now is it a great idea? That's all I don't get. You know, if they'd wanted to do it, they could have done it ages ago. It's not a new innovation that we couldn't accomplish, like maybe IMAX or 3D or color. You know, you needed technology. Well, we've got it. We've been able to do this for a long time, and we haven't yet. There must be a reason. What do you think, Sperling?
I think that filmmakers actually need to learn how to make movies for 270 degree cinema.
Well, they could have. They could have made it in 360 degrees if they wanted to.
They actually, it's a different language.
Course it is. I know. So is color. Yes, right. But it's been available for decades and no one's ever done it. Well, no one's ever bothered except for like an installation or a special thing. They could have done it. They could have done it decades ago.
Well, I think part of the reason they didn't is technology. Remember, you were hauling around film prints and you would have to have three projectors all. Uh-huh. You can't have a film projector hanging off the ceiling the way you can with Barco Escape, because that's digital projectors hanging off a ceiling, which are quieter and are less bulky. You can get content to them without having to touch the projector itself.
So you think the only reason they haven't done it is because it was too difficult?
I think that was a large part of the reason that they haven't. Yes.
I would think it was disinterest, but we'll have to see if anybody jumps into it. James Cameron would be the one.
That's true. I think if there's anybody that can show us how to do it, it's James Cameron. Somebody get him on the phone.
I meant somebody who wanted to do it, not that it needed to be shown that it would be a great thing.
Oh, okay.
But thank you very much for writing, Ferdinand.
Yes, and if you want to write to us, again, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. You can also call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts away for free. That's usually where you can find us. You can find that information, as well as ways to follow us on Twitter, where our username is @ShowbizSandbox, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. That's where you can find our page. You can find all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as links to the work of Brooks Barnes from the New York Times. I'd like to thank him for joining us. Again, our website is showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's iamdiane.com.
Have no idea what
that's... Twin Peaks reference.
Oh, yeah, you're tying it back in from the beginning. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing on the entertainment industry or the publishing industry, you can try michaelgiltz.com or, you know, go to bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.